Well, I'm here today with Adam Wolpert of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in Adam's studio. And welcome to our show, Adam.
Thank you very much.
And
welcome to my studio.
Oh, thank you. It was so gorgeous up here. It's Sunday afternoon, the 27th of February. And even though it was raining, it was just really delightful to make the drive from Bolinas through all the different ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's such a rich environment here.
Oh, yeah.
It changes so much each few miles.
Yep. So you are a painter.
Yes.
For the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. And you've been painting 15 years, have you?
In my life, probably closer to 20 now.
Oh, okay. I
was one of the founders of this project here. Mm-hmm. We started 11 years ago.
Okay.
And my position has been arts program director, but that has meant different things over the years as our organization has evolved.
Right, right.
But that's always been more of a side job. My central focus has been painting.
Oh, but what a place to paint.
So, yeah, it's... that's been the deep path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the name of my show is Attunement, and it's the subtitle is A Guide to Mystical Experience. And so you're talking about the deep path, and I'd like to ask you how you have found the deep path, because even in the catalogs that I've seen, I look at your photographs and your paintings, and I'm drawn right in.
Hmm.
So could you talk to us about the deep path?
Hmm. I think I'm very fortunate in that I found work that feels to me like life's work mm-hmm. at a pretty early age, probably my mid-20s. I started painting. I lived in Florence, Italy for 2 years and engaged in a very classical, rigorous technical study of painting directly from nature. And I studied a method that's called the sight size method, which goes all the way back to Alberti. It has its origins in 15th century painting.
Can you describe
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's a way of painting where you set up the subject, in this case, maybe a still life or a model, in the studio alongside your painting of that subject. And then you stand away from the two, the subject and the painting, side by side. The distance you stand was prescribed by Leonardo as 3 times the greatest length of your painting. So if you've got a 2 by 3 foot painting, you want to be 9 feet away. That is in order to put the entire tableau of the subject and painting within your field of focus. Because as Leonardo and all of the great scientists of the 15th and 16th century and later masters of the Baroque period knew, your field of vision is much larger than your field of focus. Your field of focus is about 15%. And if you look at Rembrandt, you can see how he understood that the amount of a space on that canvas that you can focus on at one time is this very small area. And you'll see that in a Rembrandt portrait, the eyes, maybe a bit of the mouth, a bit of the forehead are in focus. And down at the bottom of the painting, there may be some elaborate robe or somebody sitting in a big carved chair or something. And it's painted very broadly, completely out of focus. Because the masters of that golden age of painting were concerned with actually conveying our living visual experience of nature as opposed to just making a picture that illustrates something. And if you look at later schools of painting, like Pre-Raphaelite painting, for example, where there's focus from corner to corner all the way across, you get an appearance of much more like a tapestry or the way wallpaper would appear or the way a mosaic would appear. It's not a lesser art, but it doesn't resonate with or reflect our actual lived visual experience the way a Rembrandt painting does. And these kinds of methods are rooted, well, I I got off a little bit from the side size thing. The side size thing is where you're painting directly from nature. And so you've got your painting set up here, and you've got your still life set up next to it. You're standing a few feet away, and you're looking at both of them. And Alberti described painting, defined painting, as the art of comparison. And it's the idea that you're comparing your painting to nature, be it a still life or a model or a landscape or what have you. And that that act of comparing one to the other, within that is the art of discrimination. What is like nature and what is unlike nature? How can you discriminate between the parts of your painting that are really, quote, working or resonating, and the parts of your painting that you need to work on? And by asking yourself that question over and over, what's working, what isn't working, in relationship to the nature that I'm actually looking at, you can slowly move your painting toward a place where it's singing, where it's really reflecting that apple or that pear or that person.
And how do you know?
Well, it's a kind of attunement, which is interesting. It's very much like tuning an instrument, because the method you develop is a method of moving your eyes back and forth from nature to the painting to nature to the painting. You look at the thing you're painting, let's say it's just an apple, and then you look at that, and then you look over at your painting, and then you look back at the apple, and you look back at your painting. And the things that are different, or out of tune, if you will, pop out. And the things that are coherent and the same from one image to the next resonate. They're in tune. There's not a dissonance in the image.
So you get an auditory impression, or is it?
It's a visual vibration. And you can actually get very good at this. You can get to the point where, for example, if I was painting a portrait of you, I could look at my painting and I could look at you, and if I'm painting your right eye too high up on your face, when I scan my eyes back and forth, your right eye will be going up and down like this. It'll actually be moving because it's different. It's in a different place in your face than it is in the painting.
So it is a primary visual experience.
It is.
But do you also not get a feeling about it too? I mean, how do you convey that feeling then?
Well, and that kind of progresses the discussion here, because this initially is a technical method, right, which is really used to draw something correctly. It's almost a kind of cartography where you're mapping and you're establishing relationships within your painting which are basically identical to or close to identical the relationships within the scene you're painting.
As much as you can attend to.
As much as you can.
How your human interface sees.
Right. And that initial cartography is the doorway. It's like you're able to walk into a landscape. You know, I can hand you a map and say, well, here's a map of the landscape.
Right.
And then
right.
you can walk into that landscape and be kind of located. And then I think you're open to a whole other level of feeling, of sentiment. And if you look at a Chardin still life, and I'm not sure where your listeners are in terms of art history, but...
But this is informative.
If you look at a Chardin still life, he's taken an apple or a silver goblet and really, I think, transcended into a mystical realm with that object, has really gone beyond the object into sort of the soul of the world, I think, ultimately.
Can you speak about how that's done?
I don't think I can.
Good.
I mean, I think it's beyond language. It's beyond maybe even linear thought. It's in a realm. I could certainly speak about how it's done logistically, the way you can speak about meditation, that, you know, you sit here, you breathe in this way, you assume this posture. You know, you can talk about that. But in terms of how it's done spiritually, or how that kind of alchemical transformation from paint and canvas to something transcendent and something that has a language which can actually speak to a person's soul, that's beyond.
you're saying then, by a technical execution of an idea and a comparing, but there's something else that happens.
Right. And
that's beyond the technical. Right.
And I was responding to your question of how did I get on this path, and
right.
that's what I went and did when I was 25, 26, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 27, those years. And that very rigorous technical engagement, as I said, was like a doorway. And after having that ground of classical technique, like a musician might, it's interesting how in dance and music there's still the assumption of rigorous training, whereas in painting these days, I mean, the last 50 years, that has been, for some reason, either forgotten or actually pushed away. And many painting schools no longer do engage in any kind of rigorous training the way any music conservatory would.
Really?
And that's a whole other topic. But,
right, right. But let's stay with your experience, though.
So after that, I came back to the States, and I spent a few years really just painting in the garage, my parents' house, and started my professional career in my late 20s showing those early still lives. And
this was oils, right?
This is oils, mm-hmm, painted from nature.
Okay.
And over the next decade, I moved into diverse realms in my painting, including the landscape painting, which I've been doing here at the, mm-hmm, Occidental Arts and Ecology Center for 11 years now, which is about half of my art. And then studio painting, which I do, which is much more introspective, more kind of visionary, more reflective, and that's usually I do that in the winter. And I have a lot of small images in there around the studio of fish and atmospheric kind of amorphous spaces and stones and things which are somewhat dreamlike, archetypical.
So with this discipline that was a doorway, have you found then the mystic showing up, the mystical experience, or not only from yourself, but with other viewers of your work?
Well, I don't know about other viewers. I mean, people have all kinds of experiences,
from
total disinterest to real deep connection, which I think has as much to do with them as it has to do with the painting.
Oh, absolutely.
I know in my experience, I wouldn't identify myself as a mystic in terms of, I don't think I would. I mean, I'm not sure what mystical experience encompasses. I mean, it's almost a semantic question. Well, what does that really mean? So what do you mean by mystical experience?
Well, that's part of the purpose of this series of programs, is to explore what that is. And yet, it's curious to me in reflecting to you about the things that you were speaking about in your technical training, and I'll come back to that in a minute, about the notion that there's only 15% of our visual field that is the focus, and the rest of the visual field is out of focus, but it provides a context. And to be able to attend, I mean, that this is very informative. There's all sorts of flashbulbs going off in my mind right now, a Harper and as a person in radio and communications. And by the way, we're speaking with Adam Wolpert, who is the arts director of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in Occidental, California, in West Sonoma County. I mean, I know what I mean by mystical experience, and it is, I was delighted to hear you say earlier that this was a terrain that is actually beyond language. And yet, in a way, we use language to go up to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I guess the thing is, you know, in looking at some of these paintings, and even in the 2004 catalog, I noticed there was a scene in a garden with some trees around it, and the foliage, the plants that were being cultivated had a very crisp focus, and the trees and so forth around the edges were much softer,
mm-hmm,
So this is really informative. Mm-hmm. And my experience of that painting was, I wondered why you did that, because it looked like there were two different sorts of styles going on, but it really gave the whole painting a three-dimensional mm-hmm. effect. And the thing that is also amazing to me is that the painters of that time, of Leonardo's time, were attending to art at this level.
Oh, far more sophisticated, I think, than mm-hmm. than we are now. I think in the realm of sophistication, our technical sophistication now has replaced our sort of human sophistication, the way that we understand humanity, each other.
That we can take a picture with a digital camera and have
it show
up.
Yeah, and we can
pixels.
Fly things into space, and we can make cell phones work and do all of these really quite miraculous feats outside of ourselves. Most of those feats, it seems to me, occur outside of humanity. There's a certain kind of, but there's a kind of externalizing, which I think has happened over the last few hundred years.
You mean the focus going to the technology
rather than
to humans?
Going not only outside of our bodies, but actually outside of our real concerns, our human concerns of relationship and our place in a web of life and our place in the community of other living things, not just communities of humans, mm-hmm. but communities of living things which are interdependent. That kind of attention, I think there's a scarcity of that kind of attention.
And welcome back. And during the break, Adam and I were talking, and Adam was talking about your experience of painting, which is mystical, that is in the way of your experience of connection.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say some more about that?
Well, sure. I mean, this word mystical is
right.
It's kind of amorphous and defined in so many different ways. For me, I think it has to do with connection. And I believe that we are all part of a much greater web of life. And of course, this is not my idea. It's more and more actually proven out by science, so-called Western science.
And the quantum theory.
As has been spoken in so many religious traditions, that we are all part of one greater whole. And if you study ecology, which is really the study of relationships, there's a deep underlying truth to living systems of connectivity. And the strength and the depth of the connections between the different parts often is a good indicator of the strength of the system that you're studying, be it a pond or a forest or a whole region. When I go out and paint, one of the things I sometimes get to experience on really good days is a sense of my part in a much greater whole. We were talking a little bit about Merleau Ponty during the break, this phenomenologist who
right.
David Abrams talks about extensively in his book, Spell of the Sensuous, which is a very beautiful book about our relationship to nature and the way we perceive nature in our lives. And Merleau Ponty's work is about the way we participate when we perceive. When you perceive something, when you see something, you are actually participating in that thing. That you're seeing it is being part of it. And it, simply put, perception is participation.
Now, that's a very profound idea.
It
and
is.
That goes right to the notion of the connectivity that you
were
speaking about.
Right. I mean, as a landscape painter, initially you might have kind of an alienated position from the landscape where you're looking at it maybe as you would from the window of a car or a train. You're in another space, you're in another place, you're maybe moving at a different rate, but you're seeing it mm-hmm. as if it was far away from you. But as you become more engaged with the activity of painting a place, I think with that engagement comes a sense of belonging, and you become more part of that place. And in that way, you can experience yourself as part of a greater whole, which is a kind of self-transcendence. It's a transcendence of the self as an individual ego and a moving into a sense of a larger system of which you're a small part. And I think that experience could be put in the category of mystical experience, the experience mm-hmm. of transcending yourself and taking your place in a larger whole.
You're talking about participating as a viewer, but the viewer and the viewed are not different, is right. what you're saying.
Right.
And even when people look at your work, that experience continues, does it not?
Well, I could only hope.
right.
I mean, I one of the things I think that work does is speaks of a human experience of mm-hmm. perception, and as we're saying, even more than just perception, of participation in nature. And I think we all are capable of participating in this way mm-hmm. and of transcending ourselves as we do enter this kind of participation. But it's difficult. I mean, we have a lot working against us in terms of the din of
the social trance, for that matter, to say, oh, you're different than me. I'm a XYZ and you're not a XYZ. And
well, that, of course, and just the speed of our lives and the din of the world and mm-hmm. of internet and advertising and whatnot. But when we can move into enough stillness to actually feel that sense of participating as we perceive, it's a very generous place. And as we, as ecologists, as we study ecosystems, mm-hmm. there is more and more of a revealing that is occurring, for example, in the mycelial web. The mycelial web of fungus, which floats on the oceans and runs in the forests, which Paul Stamets, a very great mycologist, calls the nature's internet. This idea of this vast web of fungal tentacles, which move under us and over our oceans, that keeps all of the different organisms in an ecosystem in touch with one another. And most of the relationships in a mature ecosystem, and uh-huh. you study this in the study of permaculture, which mm-hmm. is one of the things that we do here at the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. We have permaculture design courses.
Right.
And you study mature ecosystems, so-called sustainable, or at least sustainable in larger time frames. Mm-hmm. You find that most of the relationships are symbiotic relationships.
You can't have flowers without bees, or bees without flowers, in a simplistic way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that most of the roots and the trees, you even find in mature redwood forests a resource distribution occurring, where certain...
Oh, I've read about this.
Yeah, where resources which are scarce in one area of the forest and abundant in another are actually moved through... biodynamic highways from one place to another. And there's, you know, I think we've come out of the last century with a very kind of dog-eat-dog model of uh-huh. nature. And in fact, I think with the new sensitivity that we're developing with our study of biology and ecology, we're getting to a point of seeing how actually sensitive and delicate and cooperative and synergistic natural systems are, as opposed to being mm-hmm. mostly competitive and just kind of tooth and nail and survival of the fittest.
Well, and that's something that many native peoples have known for millennia.
Of course. And so how this relates to painting or art making, I think that all of us, in one way or another, I imagine anyway, feel some of this scarcity of relationship and are interested in moving back to a more connected place. And art is one of the ways to do that, and painting is one of the little ways in the arts to do that. When you sit and you start to deeply relate to a place visually, but of course in landscape painting you have so much more than the visual. You have the smell, you have the sound, you've got yes. the animals that come and visit you, you've got the changing light, you've got the changing sky above you, you can feel the way the clouds are moving and the way the pressure is changing. And so it's a very whole body kind of tactile thing.
Which you are a part of. You're not different than it.
You're part of that.
And so yeah. in a way, is in a very clear way, is your painting.
Yes, that's right. And you know, sometimes you have, sometimes it's more difficult to connect to that mm-hmm. greater wholeness, to really open up. I mean, the challenge, I think, for all of us is to open and to kind of let go of these preconceived notions and these preconceived images. As a painter, you're always fighting the image that you're holding in your mind, because that image is always a restriction.
Because it isn't what's actually you're
yeah,
sitting in.
Right.
Oh, I see.
You know, sometimes this is called symbolic seeing. If you're looking for your mother in New York's Grand Central Station, you will be scanning the crowd for somebody who matches the image in your head that is your mother. And until somebody matches that image, you actually won't recognize your mother, and you'll see them much more completely. And sometimes people talk about this when they encounter old friends who they don't recognize immediately. And they'll say, well, who is that old man? Look at that old man over there. Oh, my God, that's Bob. You know, or that's my dad, or that's my mom. Well, that's real seeing. And in the training of a painter, you're trained to stop seeing the sun that you know in your head and start seeing the actual man in front of you, stripped of these preconceived notions. And it takes a lot of discipline to do this, because one of the ways we survive in the world is by reducing things down to symbols. Mm-hmm. And so if you're driving down the freeway, of course, you can't fully take in, you know, as Huxley called the doors of perception. You right. can't just throw open your doors of perception, because you'll have a crash. You need to limit and reduce in order to facilitate the navigation in that space, because you're moving fast and the stakes are very high. But when you sit quietly in a garden
yes.
and you're not moving fast and the stakes aren't very high in terms of survival, you can train yourself to start opening mm-hmm. and start seeing things in this completely different way.
A completely different way than one
than
was.
Than you thought they looked. Uh-huh. You know, the garden on a Sunday afternoon in June doesn't look like you think it looks. I mean, I find it's interesting when I'm often in the company of people who are not painters and who don't engage in this kind of visual, rigorous visual practice. And often I'll be down at the ocean with somebody, and I'll look out at the ocean, and the ocean will be purple or it'll be red. And I'm always startled by it, because I'm always thinking, oh, how would I paint that? And I'll say, wow, God, look at the ocean's red. And the person I'm with will often say, what do you mean the ocean's red? It's not red, it's blue. Because the ocean's blue
is... That's how we colored it in grade school.
That's our mind. That's in our mind.
How do you do that? How do you... What is the discipline, if I may ask?
Well,
speak about it.
It goes back to the sight size practice, this idea of slowly and steadily and rigorously over time comparing your painting to nature, until you get to a point that you forget about what you think an apple looks like or a piece of glass looks like, and you move into what it actually looks like, which is it's a pattern of shapes which have values and colors, mm-hmm. and those shapes have boundaries which are either hard or soft. And when you start to see the world in terms of just a relationship of shapes that have values and colors, and you start regarding the boundaries between those shapes as hard or soft, then, I mean, it's obviously things become very abstract. And again, you don't want to be seeing the world like that if you're driving down the freeway at 70 miles an hour.
Well, but I struggle with that one.
If you're in the studio and you start seeing the world that way, you forget what you're looking at. And this is a very magical moment. There's a great book that I love called Seeing is Forgetting the Name of What You're Looking At.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Bob Irwin is a California artist who's a light. He works a lot with light and mm-hmm. perception. And I think everyone out there who's listening has had the experience at one time or another of walking into a room or into a, you know, you get out of your car in a parking garage or it's twilight or mm-hmm. something. And you have a perception of the world around you which is indecipherable. You yes. cannot figure out, like, is that the sky or is that the, you know, is that the ceiling of the parking lot or is that, you know, you have that moment, right? Mm-hmm. And you're looking and you're seeing and you don't know what you're seeing. You don't know what that thing is. And it's a moment of pure perception, pure vision.
Because it isn't bounded by concept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you can get to that place as a painter, when you can paint beyond idea, you can also paint beyond criticism. And that's one of, I mean, this is a new concept in the discussion, but that's one of the things that I think really holds us back as artists is the voice of, you know, that really, that's a really bad tree. Right.
Oh, how it was drawn,
like,
you mean?
Yeah, like, oh, that's, you know, that should be better. You're looking at your painting and you're thinking about what the way it should look, and you're being limited by your critical voice saying, oh, you know, that should look different. That should look this or that. That should look like a Van right. Gogh, or that should look like a illustration, or, you know, whatever your sensibilities are.
And was there not an extreme... there was an extreme thing about a kind of painting that was realism, I guess. I can't remember the name of it. Things look like, they try to make things look like a photograph. Mm-hmm. So we have to take another break, but stay tuned. One of the things in your article that's on adamwolpert.com, Wolpert, is you said... as I look into the eyes of this world, I'm so often filled with troubling questions. How can this life be so beautiful and at the same time so filled with grief? In your experience as a painter, how do you... And also, at the end of your article, you said if you can ask a person about how they think about art, and you can tell a lot from that person. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about the sense of beauty and grief?
Mm. Well, it's just there's a lot of grief. There's so much tragedy here in Sonoma County. You read about it in the newspaper more than seeing it at the end of your driveway. For many of us, so it can become abstract.
You mean in the newspapers and
the vast mm-hmm. Suffering of the world that is expressed in so many ways. I mean, be it war and human catastrophe and human horror or natural disaster and being mm-hmm. in the wrong place at the wrong time, like in the tsunami or these earthquakes. I mean, there's obviously a big part of the human experience is suffering, and it's again beyond words. It's beyond the rational. I don't hold that there's some way to explain all of this suffering. Mm-hmm. That somehow people are suffering because they're being punished or something of that nature. I think it's fundamental to our experience as humans. And I think that artists who are engaged in a deep and earnest search come up against this question of suffering. Because when you sit, I mean, whether you're sitting in meditation or sitting in painting, mm-hmm. when you sit with yourself, you have moments anyway of transcending yourself and really just sitting with humanity and sitting with the larger part of yourself, which is everyone, which is, you know, I think each one of us, we're an individual, but we're also part of a greater whole.
Well, and particularly in where you live, you're in a collective here.
I'm in a community, yeah. So I'm part of the 20 people I live with. And
right. And
then those of us who are lucky enough to be in contact with things in nature, not just in the concrete jungle of a city, we then also feel part of the animals and the plants and the environment, the mm-hmm. natural environment. And reflections on suffering, I think, almost always attend reflections on beauty. And I don't know if that's true for other people, but it usually mm-hmm. I find that to be true for myself, that when I really key in to just the exquisite, vast beauty of the world, suffering's right there. It's part of that.
Because I'm just thinking about how Van Gogh had such difficulty, and I know that now psychologically people think about him having been schizophrenic, and yet there's such extraordinary power that comes through his work. And yet at the same time, we hear that he suffered terribly.
Mm.
And I don't know that necessarily suffering goes hand in hand with transcendence, although it's certainly, you know, where does one go, you know, in the suffering? And certainly the Buddhists talk about, well, the Buddha said you suffer because you're attached. Well, mm-hmm. that sounds sort of pat, you know, but certainly being involved. And I wonder, like, if the annuals that you paint in the garden, if they suffer,
right.
you know? But, yeah. I mean, they're only here for a while or, you know.
Well, that idea of the temporal, of the passing or the fleeting, that mm-hmm. as a landscape painter, I mean, I think all painters grapple with this to some degree, but landscape painters are really up against the fleeting quality of our life. I mean, mm-hmm. just absolutely from the start, every shadow in front of you is moving. Every tree in front of you is either turning its leaves or losing its leaves or getting its leaves. Or right now I'm out trying to paint these flowering trees. And just a few days ago, they were just starting to flower. And now right. the ground is covered with petals.
Yes.
And if you really are into landscape painting in a place, the way I am here, mm-hmm. you can really get caught up, and it's almost a kind of a panic that, you know, you're missing it. You're missing it. You know, I spent 3 hours yesterday painting this one scene over on one slope, whereas I know on the other slope, these trees that have just started blooming are already getting their leaves. Uh-huh. These deciduous oaks around here, when the leaves come back, they come back this vivid coral color that is so beautiful and is so fleeting. I mean, it really is a week or 2 weeks only before they start transitioning into green. And uh-huh. And so when you're out painting, you're so aware of change and you're so aware of the change outside of you. But of course, upon reflection, you have to admit that that change is happening inside of you as well, that it's not just the leaves that are changing. It's your body that's changing. It's your life that's passing as quickly as the day in reality, because you're part of it. If you feel connected,
yeah.
then you experience as a painter, and probably all sorts of other people experience this in other ways. But as a painter, I experience my life passing very vividly almost constantly, almost all the time, there's that sense there. And and so, you know, as soon as you delight in having something in your hand, it's gone. And that's, I think, one of the things about painting that's so poignant is that you can capture this moment. And I mean, I think one of the things about Vermeer, you brought up Vermeer earlier, that is that's so entrances the public. I went back to Washington, D.C. to see the Vermeer show there. Mm-hmm. And it was in the winter, and thousands of people waiting in freezing cold for hours and hours and hours in these lines just to see the show of 40-some-odd paintings. And what is it about Vermeer? And there's so many people write about Vermeer. Yeah. What is it? And I think the stillness in his paintings, the sense of a moment that really has been just held, to be able to make everything still in this moment is so touching to people because we don't get that.
The stillness, you mean?
The stillness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that you've spoken to Zen meditation practitioners, and mm-hmm. there are a lot of mystical traditions that emphasize the importance of stillness.
Right.
You need to get real still and real quiet. And there's something in that stillness for you. I think painting is like that, too. I think that there's something in the deep, quiet stillness that can be achieved in a painting which transcends the temporal realm.
Okay. I'm just envisioning some of the paintings that Vermeer did, and also particularly that film impressed me so much because, you know, you could stop the DVD player at any frame, and you know, the cinematography was gorgeous in that way, and they were all, it was a succession of stills in a fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It because did. The composition was just, I'd never seen a film like it.
It was like walking into one of his paintings.
Right. Yeah. Other than the only other film I saw like it that was even close, and it was more about immediacy and color, was a film called Blowout by Antonioni from the late 60s. I don't know if you remember the, but there were some very vivid greens in that. But so it's the stillness, but also there's an eternal quality in that stillness, and also the adjective of luminosity.
You know, when your question about nature and art. I mean, I think art and nature, those two words, have a lot to do with one another and mm-hmm. in some ways can be interchanged. And you read that piece, when somebody tells you something about their feeling about a work of art,
right.
You learn a lot about them. When you approach nature as an artist and you try to paint, quote, paint it, you know, paint a scene, paint a tree, paint a... I'm going to come and
paint this
thing.
Yeah.
What you end up really with is more of a portrait of yourself. What you're really doing is you're giving evidence to your perception of that part of nature, which is very, very limited. I mean, of course, we only see...
Well,
this
into the
little,
15% focus.
Well, there's that, and then there's light. I mean, what we call visual light is this tiny band of nanometers that do you remember what it is? 300 or 600 nanometers, something
right.
Small mm-hmm. on this vast spectrum of radiation.
Yeah, phenomena, yeah.
And we make everything in the world out of this little tiny bit. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, most humans are not using all of their capacities. And so you're even a little subset of what we could do ideally.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up being our vision of nature. And yeah, we say something about the garden we're painting, but what we're mostly talking about in that painting is our experience of seeing. And
right, that it's in some, that it's actually one's own experience of what one sees.
And that's what's being conveyed. And for me here, I've been painting the same scenes over and over again for 10 years. And so I can actually pull out paintings of the same stuff that's 5, 10 years old and see how much, in fact, I am painting myself. As we change, and as we open, mm-hmm. we become much, we become aware of how much we don't see.
Or perhaps how much one has chosen not to see. And maybe, and my point is that many of the choices that we make to artificially discriminate, I mean, one has to do that to go from A to B or something, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That many of those choices have become unconscious, and then we forget that we even made them.
That's right.
So then that's just how it is, and then the job becomes of coming back to getting in touch with the ground. I mean, right to the point of grinding your paint. I mean, you have the ground in your hands. Mm-hmm. You feel it, mm-hmm. you know. But it also strikes me as that many of these landscapes have become your friends in an odd way.
Yeah.
I mean, they're old friends, and they change, and you change. And
right.
But in a way, I mean, you participate.
Right. And that's where I think the deep satisfaction is. Mm-hmm. I think some people, even some of the people I live with, right. think it's a bit strange that I remain fascinated with, I mean, there I am, you know, there it is. He's sitting there, he's painting that view again. And not only that, but I mean, this last fall, this one view from the kitchen, I did about mm-hmm. 12 paintings. They're all the same scale and they're all done sitting in the same spot. This isn't unusual. I mean, Monet painted this way. A lot of people paint in series. But for me, it never ceases to be engaging and fascinating because it's not that you're just getting the job done, you know, illustrating something or documenting something and right. getting the job done. It's more that you're actually participating in this living, breathing landscape, and it's a delightful, privileged position to be in, to be able to sit in this life with all of this whirling around you and moving and breathing and growing and give evidence to that human experience with this painting. You know, the painting kind of gives evidence to that human moment.
Well, the word that I'm hearing also in my mind is vitality.
That vitality.
There's an incredible aliveness.
Yeah.
Because when you participate, there is not the separation between you and it in the Cartesian sort of way of subject and object. And I was thinking about, well, you know, many of the listeners may feel alienated from their everyday experience. And part of my intention in talking with people about attunement is, how do we bring life back into our life? And you've just spoken about it in mm-hmm. in the joy of participating.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And to, you know, if you feel that alienation, I think we all feel alienation in some pocket of our lives.
Right.
What I think that alienation is a lack of connection, a lack of connectedness, a scarcity of relationship. And that lack of connection is a kind of, a result of a block, like the way you'd feel if you walked into a room of people who speak a language you don't speak. And you have this lack of language with them, and you could feel alienated in that room because they're all speaking and you can't speak to them and they can't speak to you. And you need to hook it up with them by opening a conduit, and maybe that would be learning their language, or maybe it would be finding some other language that you have in common. The practice of painting, and for me, is the practice of building and keeping strong and healthy and open that conduit where, and it is like a language, where I can connect. And I often can't. I sit out in the landscape for many, 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 many hours, and only a small percentage of those hours are spent feeling this sense of connectedness. It's not easy to come by. It's a result of building that capacity to connect. And then sometimes it opens and it's just effortless. Mm-hmm. Like if you're learning a language, that first moment when you experience fluency, when you think in the language.
In the language, exactly.
And you forget that you're speaking Italian. You're just speaking.
Right.
And then you think, oh, God, you know, I've worked so hard for so long to have that happen to me.
Right.
It's sort of that way with painting.
But then it happens instantly.
Right, and unfortunately with painting for me, you have to keep learning it over and over. There's a tide. There's a coming and a going. There's a kind of a breathing, and you enter periods of darkness where you do feel alienated and you do feel like you can't connect, and then all of these, you know, questioning voices come up and you think, well, what am I doing? And what's the meaning of this? And what good is this anyway? And all of that. And then if you stay in that space with real earnest intention, that tide will then recede and you can get back to that.
And we're back. And you had just been speaking about the truth of grappling with material limitations as a human person, and the kind of a tidal ebb and flow and the sort of change of the seasons,
mm-hmm.
that sometimes you'll go out and sit in the woods and it'll be tough to
to connect. Yeah, it is. It is cyclical, and that sense of connection is cyclical. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just really uncomfortable to go and try to paint. And, you know, some different language comes up around this block, artist block, you know, that term you hear, the idea of being blocked. I think that's a very good term because, again, this theme of connectivity, mm-hmm. when the conduit is open, when it's strong and open, you really feel that enjoyment, the delight of flow and connection, and it's fun and it's exciting and there's discovery and there's it's a wonderful experience. And then there are times when it's just blocked and you can't connect to your painting, or you can't connect to your view. I think most landscape painters who go out and paint know the experience of you set up one place, you try to paint, you can't connect, you go somewhere else, you try to paint, you can't connect. Sometimes you end up driving around all afternoon, mm-hmm. or in my case, maybe walking around the garden all afternoon, scraping it off, wiping it out. You know, there's this sense of trying to open that conduit, mm-hmm. trying to become fluent or find a fluent language, and just not being able to sometimes. And like the cycles of the moon or the changes of the seasons, I've come to finally understand after trying to do this for almost 20 years that there is a faith that you can hold that the darkness passes into light. And there is a moderating or mitigating knowledge you can hold that the light passes into darkness. So when you're really connecting, that's not going to last forever. So when it stops, you're not shocked and horrified, and you don't go into panic that, oh my God, I won't be able to connect again. Mm-hmm. And when you really aren't connecting, you know that if you keep showing up and you keep a certain faith in the cycles, that when you do come back into relationship in a good way and you do start to really experience a kind of alignment or harmony between yourself and your painting and your world around you, that it'll be deeper, that it will be informed by that passage through the darkness, that it'll be somehow enriched by struggling.
And you've, from having stayed with the process.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. Now, you know, and again, after a couple of decades, you get to a point where you've gone through these cycles enough that they mm-hmm. become familiar. Mm-hmm. And like the seasonal cycles, they're familiar, but that doesn't mean you get to avoid the winter depression or you get to avoid the euphoria of spring, which can be a bit manic sometimes, right. Maybe, you know, and whatever. You still experience all those things, but you can step back and have a bit of a broader view and see that, oh, here are the doubts again, and here's the, you know, here's the... Here's the joy cycle again, and that kind of greater perspective also, I think, connects to this theme of mysticism mm-hmm. because one of the
right.
one of the core principles of the mystical path is detachment, the idea of being able to not be attached, like to the fruits of your action. Or to the pain that you're experiencing, to be able to, like in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, let the senses play with their objects. And you kind of watch from above, you know, where you mm-hmm. see all this stuff going on, and it is in fact happening to you, but you're not all caught up in it. Mm-hmm. You're not attached to it.
Well, and it's, yeah, participation without... Without identification, I suppose.
Identification and judgment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you can become gentler. It's not, oh, it's a bad day. I mean, what I finally learned is when I come home from a day of painting and my partner says to me, how was your day of painting? The best thing I can say is I painted. Because invariably, the paintings that I think are really good at the end of the day aren't. And the ones that I have harsh judgments about or strong feelings of negativity about often turn out to be some of the most interesting work I do. You just don't know what's good or bad because you're so caught up in the process.
So close to it.
You're so close to it right. that what you're really passing judgments on is your experience. Mm-hmm. It's not the work.
Well, we're at the end of our time, and I just want to thank you so much for having me come by, and I'd like to come by and visit again.
Great. And, it was really wonderful to have you.
We've been talking with Adam Wolpert, who is the director, the artistic director of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center that's in Occidental, California, in Sonoma County.